So we have the potential of a wonderful destiny. But how far are we on that line, I wonder? Individually and collectively, perhaps not yet very far. But we live in hope. And those rules, the metal rules, are there to help us evolve and unfold that hope and make it a reality. Hazrat Inayat Khan says, in fact, hope is more than a faculty or a quality. Hope may be called the substance of life. Wise and foolish, rich and poor, strong and weak, all live in some hope. There is a Sanskrit saying that Brahma, in the creation, took honey from all the flowers, and that this honey was hope. What a beautiful idea. And hope is strengthened by reason, but it stands on the foundation of patience. In other words, we may have hope and belief, and our reason tells us, yes, I've read in the scriptures that our destiny is to serve and evolve into the divine presence, to be aware of the divine presence. But that process takes time. It takes work. And that requires patience. It's the one virtue that nobody wants to acquire. We say, yes, I wish I was more patient, but we don't really wish it. If we wished it, we would be more patient. And we also have to understand that we are only one aspect of life. We're so intoxicated by our individuality. We think that there's me, and then there's the rest of the world. But actually, we're only a ray of the divine sun. We're only just part of the stream. We think we're individual, but we're just a wave on the surface of the sea, temporary. And someday that wave will fall back into the ocean, and another wave will be formed. Hazrat Inayat Khan says, when the soul comes into the physical world, it receives an offering from the whole universe. And that offering is the body in which to function. It is not offered to the soul only by the parents, but by the ancestors, by the nation and race, by the whole human race. This body is not only an offering of the human race, but an outcome of something that the whole world has produced for ages. We're part of a tremendous process that's been going on since the beginning of creation. And here we are with the possibility of awakening to real consciousness, awakening to infinite consciousness that extends beyond our little tiny fragment. The body is not only an offering of the human race, but is an outcome of something that the whole world has produced for ages, a clay which has been kneaded 1,000 times over, a clay which has been prepared so that in its very development it has become more intelligent, more radiant, and more living, a clay which appeared first in the mineral kingdom, which developed in the vegetable kingdom, which then appeared as the animal, and which was finished in the making of that body which is offered to the new coming human soul. As Radhanayat Khan also says, what about rocks, mountains, seas, and rivers? Are they not the outcome of the soul? Interesting question. Are they not the outcome of the soul? Nature in general, in its various aspects, is the naturalization of that light which is called divine spirit. But not everything in nature has what man understands by soul. For he recognizes only that ray which functions in the human body as a soul. He does not recognize the ray which functions in the lower creation to be the same, although it comes from the same source. There are two things. There are the rays, and there is light from which they spring. If the rays are the source of the soul of human beings, then the light of that same divine sun is the spirit of the whole of nature. It is the same light, but not divided, not distinct, as are the rays which we call souls. So we have a tremendous heritage, a tremendous possibility. And Mevlana Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, said something really remarkable. He said, you are more precious. You are more precious than both heaven and earth. You know not your own worth. And then he said, sell not yourself at little price, being so precious in God's eyes. Now, what does he mean, sell not yourself at little price? Well, when we give in to an impulse that we know is not so good for us, aren't we really selling ourselves for whatever it is, a little bit of pleasure or the moment of satisfaction that comes from that little surrender? We're selling ourselves for what? For whatever it is. I don't have an example in mind, but I'm sure you can furnish your own examples. Sell not yourself at little price. Value yourself as much as God values you, but not your identity, not your me. Value that which extends beyond the limitation of your you, beyond the heaven, beyond the earth. That is who you really are. That is who you really are. And when you are conscious of that, well, then it's not so hard to meet life with a smile in all circumstances, because then we become happiness itself. That is our true nature, is happiness. It's not that we come to the spiritual path looking for happiness. Well, perhaps we do in the beginning. Maybe we're confused, maybe we're sad. We come to the spiritual path, but the happiness was actually there all along. We just lost sight of it. Well, let me just read one last bit of Hazradanayat Khan. I don't want to keep you too long. I'm sure you all want to run out now and read the metal rules. This is a portion of something that we actually read during a retreat. The influence of the spirit works through the whole life. By spirit, I mean one's soul, one's personality. In Sufic terms, the same spirit is called the heart. In other words, the influence of the heart works through the whole life. Success or failure, happiness or unhappiness, all depend upon the condition of the spirit. The mystic knows it as the physician knows the science of medicine. The outer diseases are recognized by science and treated by the physicians, but the inner disorders, which are caused by the different conditions of the heart, remain unexplored by what is called modern science. Once there is a wound in the heart, the whole personality of the wounded becomes embittered. He feels agitated against all things. Every movement around him has a jarring effect upon his life. Do you recognize this? Yes, I know someone like that, you may say. Look in the mirror. Do you recognize this? Who is here who does not have a wound in the heart? We all suffer from that. Once there is a wound in the heart, the whole personality of the wounded becomes embittered. He feels agitated against all things. Every movement around him has a jarring effect upon his life. This constant irritation keeps him agitated through all conditions of life. He shows this agitation to a friend and to a foe both. He disagrees with all he accepts and does not accept. So whether one accepts or not doesn't matter. I still disagree with it. He gets into disagreeable moods. Do we? Yes? Say yes. Admit it. We do get into disagreeable moods. When there is nothing he agrees with, even he cannot agree with himself. Uh-oh. Others blame him, dislike him, avoid him, escape from him, call him a difficult person, not knowing that it is not the person who is difficult. It is some difficulty he possesses in himself, which he himself knows not, but finds every outer reason, object, or person that he touches at that moment to be the cause of his agitation. In this way, the real cause remains hidden, and that person turns from bad to worse. Here's the sad part. Few will help this person, and fewer still will understand. It is a matter of, what was that virtue? Patience, exactly. It is a matter of patience, endurance, tolerance. Besides a keen insight into human nature to understand a person's condition. It is natural that a person with a wound must fret. The wounded must show restlessness, dissatisfaction. Nothing to him is tasteful, nothing agreeable. There's nothing on which he can set his hope. It is often the case that the person himself is at a loss about his own complaint. If it were an outer wound, the wounded might see for himself, oh, I have a hole. But the inner wound he himself cannot realize. He only feels pain and he does not know where it comes from. When looking for reasons, everything, every being, every condition that presents itself before him, he attaches all blame to, because that is human nature. The work of the Sufi, therefore. Now listen. This, we can all identify with this person, and we can all say, yes, I have met such a person. So this advice now is not only for our own healing, but also to help those around us, because it's no good being on the path without trying to help others. That's what we just heard about seva. So we have to serve. We have to try to help others. The work of the Sufi, therefore, is to stop and think before being annoyed and see what is the matter with a person, to find out what is at the back of it, to find out where is the sore, where is the wound which is hidden. Then his work is to wash that wound with the water of life and try to heal it. What it needs is cooling, not irritating, which is mostly done by the ignorant. Annoyed with the wounded, they give back a little more irritation. And of course, it just gets worse and worse and worse. No, it is the cooling which is required. A word of love, of affection, a word of consoling can cool its irritation. Love which manifests as tolerance, as forgiveness, that love it is which heals even the wounds of the heart. Only patience is required, and a continual work with faith and confidence in the divine power of love. Let that be our navigation chart for the summer school and for our life as we leave here. Well, the tradition is that at the end of a talk, we say, are there any questions? I can't imagine that there's anything you would have to say about it. It's all so obvious. But are there any questions? Zora, let's get a microphone.